are here, and I have a great treat for you here today. Vernon Burton is with us here today. Vernon Burton, how you doing today?
I'm well, thank you.
You know, and I'll bet most people might not even know who you are, but you are a professor of history and the director of the Clemson Cyber Institute. You have been Burroughs Distinguished Professor of Southern History and Culture at Coastal Carolina. And presently, you are president of the Southern Association of Historians. Is that right?
Yes.
That's right. So you are quite versed in so many different things. From 96 originally, moved away, went to Princeton, went to Illinois, and then you decided to come home. And here you are back here in 96. How you doing today?
I'm well. Always good to be here, and historians like to talk, so this is a great opportunity.
Absolutely. So, you know, what brought you back to 96? You were up in Illinois, right?
That's right, University of Illinois. I taught Southern history for 34 years at the University of Illinois. Then I wrote a book on Abraham Lincoln, The Age of Lincoln, which did very well, got me on television, got me on NPR and a lot of radio. And I always wanted to come home. I wanted to, taught Southern history, study Southern history in the South. So I took the opportunity when I was offered the endowed chair at Coastal Carolina University, the Burroughs Distinguished Professor of Southern History and Culture, to move back home, only to learn that in the South, the culture wars has had a terrific effect, and people here no longer like Abraham Lincoln very much. So I hope you don't judge my choice of where I live and what I study now that I'm a Lincoln scholar in the South versus a Southern historian in the North as to the quality of my other judgments on history.
Well, I know you also wrote a book on Benjamin. Benjamin Mays did the
That's
introduction,
right.
Or is that correct?
That's right. Dr. Mays was a dear friend of mine.
You know, we had the Benjamin Mays historical site over there at the Gleams office,
right.
And we covered that, and that was that is phenomenal.
Yeah, I was there, and we're about to have another big program on, I believe, if I got my dates right, it's in September, and I believe it's a Saturday, and I believe it's September the 8th. There's going to be a panel of scholars there. They have done a South Carolina Educational Television. They're doing a little video to run for everyone who's been inducted to the South Carolina Hall of Fame, so they're announcing that. They've got it done, and there's going to be a panel about 12. I'm driving back. I'm on the Furman Alumni Board, so I'm driving back. If I don't get a speeding ticket, I should be back in time to participate in that. And I was there at the other event, which was really very good with Andrew Young and so many other
distinguished
people.
It was. I got to
people.
Speak to him.
Yes,
yes.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's invited back, whether he'll come or not, I don't know, for this other event that was sort of acknowledged me. But there are two young scholars, one black and one white, both friends of mine who I've invited, and they have just finished biographies of Ben Mays, the first full academic biographies of Dr. Mays, and I like both of them, but I think we'll get a good discussion going on the significance of Dr. Benjamin E. Mays, who I would argue is maybe the greatest individual to come out of South Carolina, though he's not known as much as he should be, but he certainly was an extraordinarily influential man.
Well, as president of Morehouse for so many years, he influenced so many people in that position.
That's right. The whole idea of what's called the Morehouse man, this proud African-American, competent individual, a leader, and Martin Luther King is just one. There's so many others, Julian Bond, Andrew Young, you can go on down, Lerone Bennett, who disagrees with me but is a good friend, about Abraham Lincoln, who was a long-term editor of Ebony Magazine and done a lot of good history. All of these were, quote, the tradition of the Morehouse man, and that was in many ways created by Dr. Benjamin E. Mays, who is, you know, I like to say a native of 96, but certainly from Greenwood County.
Well, actually, let's see, where was he born exactly?
Yeah, I love this because he's a real apostle, an apostle of peace. And, of course, the term Rambo didn't have that meaning at the time. A little community called Rambo, South
there
Carolina.
You go. I knew
and
it was
I thought
a small
it was
place.
I sort of like the irony there that here's a man who understood the humanity of his oppressors and was really a great apostle of peace. But he's born in Rambo, South Carolina.
Yeah.
The community doesn't really exist anymore, but out in the crossroads out from 96.
Absolutely. And he was, what, the youngest of nine children? It was a big family,
it
wasn't
was.
It?
I thought it was more, but you might be right. I don't remember the number.
We can look
it up real quick. I mean, it doesn't matter, but he was. And came back to 96 all the time. Came back to visit his friends and families. And I've often said that's one of the great tragedies of growing up in the segregated South. I did not know Dr. Mays. It was not until my senior year at Furman during Religious Emphasis Week that the associate chaplain, who was a good friend of mine at Furman, introduced me to Dr. Mays, and I discovered he was from my hometown. It was not that the leading fathers and mothers in 96 didn't want to honor Mays. It, basically, they did not know who he was. That was the way segregation was. And I like to point out to people how things have changed, because when I grew up, about the only little plaque or history memorial we had in 96 was a plaque honoring Preston Brooks, who I write about in The Age of Lincoln and also in My Father's House and Many Mansions.
And he's history. A Cain guy?
That's right. He's Cain, Charles Sumner, Senseless. And so there was a little monument to him where after this they had the largest gathering in the upcountry and they presented 10,000 canes to Preston Brooks, who had worn out his cane on Charles Sumner. In fact, hurt him so badly he did not come back for years during the Civil War. But I've often said that, you know, we learn our history not from books like The Age of Lincoln or In My Father's House or Many Mansions, but we learn our history from what people tell us is important. That is, what's on the courthouse ground where someone says, that's a historic home, and those monuments. So the one good thing about that monument is every little boy, black and white, who grew up in 96 knew the way that you were going to be honored and a plaque put up to you was to beat the living daylights out of somebody. So we were state champions in football, and I attributed all to Preston Brooks and the monument to Preston Brooks. But
to this day, they try harder than any other team I've seen as far as a football team, yeah.
But what's nice now, there is a monument to Benjamin Mays, and I think it's wonderful that you have, you know, different visions of greatness and things. Not that one is necessarily, I mean, we all have our own value system, but I think it's very appropriate now that there's not just a little monument up to Preston Brooks, but we have acknowledgement of Benjamin E. Mays and at Mays Crossroads. They have a nice little, and it's named Mays Crossroads now, I guess it was Scotch Crossroads,
A
nice monument there to him listing all of these things. There was a wonderful dedication that John Drummond was instrumental when he was senator in arranging. Coretta Scott King came, and now there are a number, and of course this wonderful home that I encourage everybody to visit right here in Greenwood.
The cabin.
That's right.
The cabin.
In fact, I'm going to bring down a group from Clemson. They have a program called Mister. I just spoke on Dr. Mays at their program. It's a program for African American men for students throughout the state. And here's, I think, truly a role model and a hero, I would say, worth emulating. So we get our ideas of who our heroes are, I think, from these monuments. And I'm very proud, as Dr. Mays was, that South Carolina finally acknowledged him as one of the greatest of his life. He was considered one of the three greatest theologians of the 20th century.
And yet he was such a mild man, a quiet person as far as everything I've seen about him. He wasn't a jump up and down and look at me type of person.
But he was a proud man, and this is what he argued, and this was the pride. He would not accept segregation. And he used theology and he used Christianity to explain why segregation was wrong. Martin Luther King Jr. was going to be an attorney. He came out of several generations on both sides of a family of ministers. And in those days, a lot of people don't remember, but if you wanted to do something for the African-American community, you became an attorney, because most ministers, not all, but they were seen as accommodationists who worked between the white and black communities to get the best deal they could, that is, a better schoolhouse, things of that nature. And so that did not appeal to King, who saw that as sort of toadying. And then he heard Mays. You had to go to chapel to hear Ben Mays, and they had convocation and chapel. And he would give these lectures or sermons, and it influenced King Martin Luther King Jr. to understand that religion was a powerful force for change and for equality, and that's why he became a minister. So Mays is called the spiritual godfather, the spiritual mentor of the civil rights movement. So he's a tremendously significant person. I think these two new biographies, he'll start getting his due and people will understand who he is.
Now, one of my questions would be, though, what if Dr. Benjamin Mays was here today? What would he think of our society today? Not so much only in the South, but in the United States. What would he see? There seems to me to be a lot of strife and a lot of things going on right now. So.
You know, I first let me preface this. I'm not a prophet. If I were, I'd make a lot more money.
Absolutely. Wouldn't we all?
I want you to know this is a true story. My book, The Age of Lincoln, won a big literary award, and they had a big thing for it, and another person won an award. It was called the Heritage Award, I believe, Literary Award, or the Heartland Literary Award, and his was for fiction, mine was for history, and they had a big book signing for us in Chicago. And there was another lady having a book signing right beside us, and there were like four people at our desk, and on her line, it went all the way out the building, which was at the Chicago Tribune building. Oh, you couldn't even see the end of the line.
And you felt very insignificant.
Well, no, I just finally said, ma'am,
Who are you?
Well, she had written a book that the median is based upon. The medium, the so it was her book was based was about, you know, being a prophet and all of this. So I think I'm in the wrong business. So I don't want to say what Dr. Mays would say, but he lived long enough to see that things had improved. But I think as Eric Holder got in trouble for our Attorney General, that he would probably agree that we have been cowards. All of us, North and South, on the issue of race. It is a very tough issue, and it's gotten even more complicated now, particularly in areas where, in hard economic times, anytime you've historically, if you look at American history, in the difficult economic times are when we really find the most difficult times in race relations, and I think there are, you know, good reasons for that.
Well, not only that, and now
they're not good reasons, but you can understand the reasons
of
why that happens, and it's gotten more complicated as you know. When I left 96 South Carolina, there were no Hispanics. Now you have a Hispanic group.
Well, that's what I was going to bring up, and now we have the Hispanics and a whole other. So it's really a third.
That's right. And I thought one of the telling moments was when in the packing house, which had years been a place in Greenwood that had hired African Americans, and then when it, you know, sort of all those people were let go and it hired Hispanics,
well,
I think they got in trouble because they were illegal, and there was a big television show about it. But I thought that really talked about some of the changing race relations in the South. Right now, there's the voter ID.
I wanted to get into that too.
Yeah, talk
a little bit about that too.
Yes, because that's being challenged now by the Justice Department under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, and that deals directly with race.
Absolutely. But tell us a little bit about the Age of Lincoln. Give us the synopsis of the Age of Lincoln.
Well, I don't know if I can tell you a little bit, but I can tell you a whole lot about the Age of Lincoln.
Well, we don't have that long.
That's too bad. how many days do we have?
We have one
have
here.
Caffeine for a 24-hour lecture.
Yeah.
I not only argue that Abraham Lincoln is a Southerner, which is sort of different than
where was he from? I thought he was from Illinois.
No, he was born in Kentucky.
Okay.
His mother and father were both from Virginia.
Okay.
So you know that their families.
Did he live in Illinois?
He moved from Kentucky. His father moved from Kentucky to Indiana. He really grew up in Indiana, and then he moved to Illinois.
Okay.
And in fact, one of the great ironies, and I may be one of the first to have written about this, is the relationship of the South and Lincoln. Springfield, Illinois, which was Lincoln's home, and you know now the capital of Illinois, was first named for none other than John C. Calhoun of South Carolina.
Why was that?
Well, because of just how many Southerners, like the Lincolns, had moved into southern Illinois, and that whole region was populated. There was a whole group of, if you take southern Ohio, southern Indiana, southern Illinois, and of course Missouri, which is no dispute, but it's all the lower parts of that is all settled by Southerners. And at first they were all, and it's interesting because there were two groups of Southerners who went. the largest majority of Southerners left not because they hated slavery, but because they didn't want to be around black people. So the racism is extraordinary, or was historically extraordinarily there. I would say probably even more so than in some of the southern areas at the time, if you had groups of people. And then you had someone like Abe Lincoln's father, Tom Lincoln, who actually, because of his Baptist faith, he hated slavery, and he moves away. I mean, there are other reasons, too, but he's always... Now, they're not abolitionists. Don't misunderstand me. There are only a few groups who are really abolitionists in the 1850s. The best estimates are, at most, by 1860, 5% of the population. But he hates slavery for religious reasons as well as for reasons of opportunity, as they see it. And that's why he leaves the slave state of Kentucky. So he has that heritage there. And one of my arguments and one of the things I try to show is that we tend to think of the American South, and especially South Carolina, because it had the largest percentage of population of whom were slave owners, as everyone owning slaves. But most white Southerners did not own slaves. And many of them resented people who owned slaves, and that was Thomas Lincoln's family who moves away to get away from slavery. And so one of the things I show is, in fact, just how many white Southerners fought for the Union, which really flabbergasted a lot of people. It really does become a civil war. If you look to see, every single state but South Carolina had a regiment that fought for the Union. And South Carolina did not, but I can document people who, and they had to sneak away from South Carolina, go to North Carolina, Tennessee, and Georgia to join unions to fight for the Red. People forget that Andrew Jackson was a South Carolinian. And, you know, he writes about my native state. So there was this old Jacksonian nationalism that was there that plays into it. Then if you add those people from Southern Illinois, Southern Indiana, Southern Ohio, who were Southerners by birth or culturally Southerners, as I would say, that is, their habits, their traditions, like Lincoln's ideas, were very much Southern, though modified, then you get a real number of whites who are fighting for the Union, not for the Confederacy. And that doesn't even count what we call galvanized Yankees. When I did this book in my father's house on Edgefield, South Carolina, people would say, well, you know, my great-great-uncle was killed and we can't find any records. And I'd look in the Confederate military records and the Union records, and they had surrendered or been captured, and they joined the Union Army, so they sent them out west to fight the Native Americans because they wouldn't have to fight white Southerners, and they became Union soldiers again. Then if people remember that African Americans, which were significant in winning the Civil War, it's partly why Lincoln, not the only reason and not the major reason, but Lincoln, you know, did the Emancipation Proclamation as a war measure, though he always hated slavery. He thought the Constitution prevented him from doing from freeing slaves, but as a war measure and confiscated property, he did the Emancipation Proclamation and then had blacks fight in the Union Army. So most of those are Southerners, too. So you really do have a civil war among Southerners that I argue actually continues into Reconstruction. But besides Lincoln as a Southerner, I argue Lincoln is also not only the greatest president, but the greatest theologian of the 19th century. So the book centers on religion quite a bit. And my book, In My Father's House, or Many Mansions, was one of the first books to take religion seriously, and people had warned me. But I've never understood why historians stayed away from religion, because it's the only thing I know that people will give up their life for, give up food, give up water, even sex or sleep, and we don't think it mattered. And it was a powerful motivating fact. You cannot understand why people were willing to die or what the 19th century was about unless you understand how central religion was to their life and their understanding of their worldview as they interpreted their world. And I argue it was a millennial age. Lincoln was different. Lincoln was not millennial, but people... am I running on too long? You want to ask me?
Fine.
Okay.
No, go ahead.
It was a millennial. I told you I can talk 24 hours without stopping on this book.
I'm going to stop you in less than 4 minutes,
okay.
Though. But go ahead here.
It was a millennial age, and by this I mean as we think about millennialism today, which is still current, still practiced, which what just this year or last year predicting the end of the world. And you know, I begin the book with the Gettysburg Address, which I argue is Lincoln's benediction. Then the first chapter starts with the Baptist minister Miller, who had predicted the end of the world and Jesus' return, the millennium. And people should have been a little wary because he had predicted before and it didn't happen. But still, they put on their best clothes and took their baths, got on top of their houses and waited for Jesus to come. Well, then when Jesus didn't come, I use as a literary trope, I think this really happened. People in the United States decided they would bring on the millennium by making the United States a utopia. That is, they would, in fact, create heaven on earth so then Jesus Christ would return. And that meant two different things in the North and the South. We understood about the North somewhat, and I think I made an original contribution on my study of the South. In other words, all the sins you were going to reform on, this is a time of great reform, temperance, no more alcohol, women's rights, prison reform, hell, you know, food reform. This is the beginning of Graham crackers, you know, all these kind of Shakers and Quakers, you know, all kind of reform. But the one that took the back, all of these took the back burner of what people thought was the greatest evil, many in the North, which was slavery. So if they get rid of slavery, they could sort of reform the United States. What we don't understand as well is that many people in the American South, particularly here in South Carolina, believe that slavery was God-ordained, that slavery was the best system in the world, and it was biblical, and therefore that you would bring on the utopia by having a slave society, which everyone had its place. And in fact, slavery was not just for African-American, but would be good for all workers, including in the North. When you have people that believe that they know God's will, that they're doing God's will, then they are hardly likely to compromise. And part of what happened is the result of that millennial ideas of the Civil War and perfecting society. Now, Lincoln was different. His religion was much more of the Jewish tradition of a corporate relationship with God, is how he understood religion. So he was not as millennial, but he was part of this millennial age. The other...
We're going to have to wind it up and come back, because right now we are getting right here to South Carolina News. We are with Vernon Burton here today. He has a PhD from Princeton. He is quite knowledgeable, and as you can see, he has a lot to say. So don't you go away. Hey, I'm Ann Eller right here with you today on WCRS right here in Greenwood. We'll be right back. Hey, if you got a question, give us a call. Maybe he'll answer it. 229-7984. That's 229-7984.
Gold, more precious than any other time in history. Do you have gold? Do you need cash? Then bring it to SFG. That's Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood. Telephone 229-6613. Don't forget, we buy diamonds too. Paying the highest prices for your gold and diamonds at Sharp Facets Gallery.
Back here at Sharp Facets Gallery. We've had a couple of questions come in about where you can get your books. Now, Vernon, where would be the best place to tell people? Can they call you? Or I know you have some books, or where would be the best place?
Well, I'm happy if they want to call me, they can get them, and I have copies that I can sell at a discount. They're also, most of them are on Amazon, and like you can go to University of North Carolina Press for In My Father's House of Many Mansions. I also have copies. I have a website, theageoflincoln.com or ageoflincoln.com. You can go there and email me if you don't find me in the phone book here in 96. And also my cell phone. You can, on the Clemson website, I guess, you can contact me.
Sure. Here's 543-2552.
That's my home number.
That's your home number.
96.
And then we had some calls in. Dan called in, and we wanted to say that the Truth of War Conspiracy of 1861. You're getting ready to go out of town on Wednesday.
That's right.
And when you come back, maybe you can give Dan a call.
I definitely will. It's been a while since I looked at that book, but I'd be happy to discuss it with him.
Yeah, so Dan, you'll just have to wait till he gets back from his trip.
And people can always email me to vburton@clemson.edu, like Vernon Burton, vburton@clemson.edu. But always happy to both sell. But I want you to know that all proceeds from my book go to gifted children, so you can take them off of your tax returns. And if they don't like it, I'll go with you and argue that my grandchildren, my 9 grandchildren, the most gifted children in the world, and therefore you should get a tax deduction for the book.
All righty then. All righty then. But You know, we've talked a little bit about the age of Lincoln. Fascinating, and of course you can get his book. Now, I just wanted to ask you, you know, O'Reilly has written a book, Killing Lincoln. What did you think? Have you read that book? Or,
I have.
Yeah? What did you think of the book? Just because it's gotten so much buzz.
Yeah, well,
yes.
You know, I
and
actually,
Bill O'Reilly is presenting it all over, yeah, so, yeah.
Well, you know, I'm different than most historians. Most historians do not like the book. And I would not say that it's a historically accurate book at all, but he and I share some ideas. You know, I argue that Lincoln's greatest legacy, Lincoln said his greatest legacy was the Emancipation Proclamation. And I don't want to downplay that. It's very important, but I don't think it was. I think the greatest thing that Lincoln did was change our concepts of liberty. And that's where Bill Riley and I sort of come together. And I think why he likes my book, even though we politically differ. I argue that before Lincoln, well, let's put it this way. Lincoln changed our very meaning of liberty, and it's a liberty that's inspired the world ever since. Before, you almost have to start back with the American Revolution inspired the French Revolution and the rest of the world to say men can govern themselves. Now, unfortunately, they were not including women or anyone else, but it was white men, and, you know, could govern themselves. So you had a republic. We want to say we have a democracy, but, you know, the United States is a republic.
Mm-hmm.
And it progressed toward, you know, when Lincoln breaks with his beau ideal, who is Henry Clay, with that all white men 21 and older should be able to vote and not just those who own property. That's a big shift from Clay's ideas and the Whigs' ideas. But we're moving toward liberty. But liberty was basically defined differently, and that is it was the liberty, it was negative liberty pretty much. That is, all rights were reserved to the state, and Lincoln changed that to positive liberty. The 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, the last two done after he were killed, guarantees people the right, in fact, to be free. You can't be a slave. To equal treatment, to the right to vote, and then the rest of the amendments after that change. What I like to say Lincoln did is he took what was our mission statement, the Declaration of Independence, which he absolutely revered, and he placed it into our Constitution, which is what, as a lawyer and a legal thinker, he really felt bound by, though there are a lot of instances, and particularly white Southerners who are still fighting the Civil War, will remind you of how often he violated the Constitution in order to win that war, but he still tried his best. I mean, that's partly why he felt he could not let South Carolina and the rest of the nation leave. The other is because I argue he's a Southerner. It was a sense of honor. You don't go against a sense of honor for Southerners. But he put the Declaration, our mission statement, into the rule book, our Constitution, and I think that's really inspired the world. And before that, though, a lot of people don't understand what was happening in the world. Because after the French Revolution, Napoleon overthrows the Republic and becomes on the throne. You have the Revolution of 1848, which is a movement again for Republican democracies and men govern themselves, and they lose. That's where all these 1848 radicals come into the United States, influencing the end of slavery and things like this. Everywhere where there has been tried to be a republic of any sort, they're failing. It leaves only the United States, even Mexico. Napoleon III puts Maximilian on the throne, the hero of two continents, in fact. Garibaldi reunites Italy, believing it's going to be a republic, and becomes a monarchy. So the South is going, the conservative South is actually much more like the rest of the world, and when Lincoln says it's the last best hope on earth, he really means it, to show that if in fact South Carolina leaves, the Confederacy leaves, then what is left, that men cannot govern themselves. So that puts it in perspective, I think, and I think the liberty and Lincoln's understanding of liberty is where Bill O'Reilly and I come to some sort of agreement. The other parts of the book I'm not as happy about.
Well, just out of curiosity, do you think that men can govern themselves today? I mean, when you look at what's happening in our Congress here today and the Senate and everything, do you think we can? It doesn't seem like we're getting much done up there, does it?
Well, no, but I think they can. I think we've proven we have, because we have men like Benjamin Mays, and we have men like Abraham Lincoln, and they're here today, and I hope they'll be elected and continue to be elected.
They're here today?
I do think we have these kind of good leaders who can help. But yeah, Congress has gotten in a situation that's not unfamiliar with us studying the Civil War. I mean, this is, we talked about Preston Brooks, Kane, and Charles Sumner. We're just
right
about there, you know, or hollering at the president of South Carolina as Representative Joe Wilson did. You
right.
lie.
Right.
You know, so we've reached a pretty quite, but they have done some amazing things when you think about it and have been able to, the student loan thing. And I'm hoping once we get through this next election, we will see more cooperation, because you're right, it's not government. We don't have a parliamentary government. That's one of the problems. We have a winner-take-all. That's what happened with Lincoln. That's what happened with Obama. You have a winner-take-all, so it leaves nobody with anything else. We're not a parliamentary form of government, so it puts huge premium on the presidency and the winning of the presidency more than almost any other country that way. So but I don't think it's as bad. I know we get upset, but there have been just as bad at times. And, you know, that's one good thing about having a historical perspective. Let's just hope it doesn't end the as we did in 1860 with these culture wars. But they had their culture wars then as well.
You know, one of my thoughts, I've been thinking a lot about this, and since we have the Internet and, you know, we are a republic rather than a democracy, I'm just wondering, Vernon, if maybe we should be a democracy and we should have to vote on a weekly basis. If you are a registered voter, that you have a PIN number, you're signed up, and you go in there and vote every week. And if not, the truest sense of a democracy, that we vote to our congresspeople and they have to vote the way the people vote that turn the votes in. That would be an interesting idea, wouldn't it?
It would be interesting. Whether it would work or not, I don't know. You know, I do think, though, times have changed, and certainly the founding fathers could have never foresaw where we are today. I actually think that they had a pretty good idea about the balances of government. And I thought, whether you agree or not, I thought it was pretty interesting. We know that Justice Roberts, another Princeton graduate, did not want to support Obamacare. It's not what he politically is. But he also thought the importance of what the court was that he ruled the way he did. And I thought that was a pretty courageous thing. I think if John Kennedy was writing his Portraits in Courage now, that would be an instant there when you're asking about leadership. I thought there was time. And I'm not talking about do you care one way or the other or mad at him, but his personal dilemma was, we are a government of laws. One of the things I loved about Lincoln was his idea of the rule of law, that laws are important. And I wasn't sure I felt that way. I grew up something of an outlaw in 96, like most of the little boys there and things. You know, we didn't like having those hunting license and those fishing license and all that. But as Lincoln argued, if you do not follow the law, then you either have anarchy on one side or despotism and fascism on the other. And I think he's probably right. And I think when it comes down to those kind of situations, that usually people try to do what's best for the country. I'm a little surprised at how long we've sustained this sort of hostility and this lack of willing to work. I mean, I go back, I remember in the Vietnam War, you know, Lyndon Johnson, his most severe critic, was from Wyoming, and they fought like crazy, and then they swapped bulls at the end of the day for breeding purposes as friends. I mean, in the days of when people would go out after would do their argument, we have turned it into a very personalized thing.
I don't think that happens now. I don't think there's reaching
across. No, that's what I'm saying.
That,
that's really, really sort of sad. Well, I think Lindsey Graham has tried to do that, and I think he has to be careful, because if you have a democracy, people might just vote him out for doing what I think is a good thing to
Same
do.
Same with John McCain.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I really do. That it's a shame, I think, because these are great legacies and some of the great things we've done. But democracy itself is messy. It really is. And yet I think it's very worthwhile our trying to pursue and work for. And a republic moves toward that way. What the founding fathers tried to do was try to figure out how you can balance all these interests, because we all have different interests and things.
Absolutely. And it is difficult to pull it all together. Hey, we are here with Vernon Burton. As you can see, he's passionate about, and he writes many books. He's a historian. He is the Distinguished University Scholar, Professor of History and Computer Science at the Strom Thurmond Institute of Government and Public Affairs at Clemson. So we are dealing with the top notch here. Hey, we're going to hear a quick word from our sponsors, then we'll be back. If you've got a question or a comment, don't hesitate to give us a call, 229-7984. That's 229-7984.
This is Philip Biffle, your Greenwood Edward Jones Financial Advisor. Do you have a recovery plan for your investments? If not, there are several reasons we think you should. While interest rates are very low, certain income strategies and investments could help increase your investment income. Also, many investment portfolios are out of balance at a time when proper investment diversification may be most critical. You also may want to review your portfolio to consider replacing lower quality investments with higher quality investments that may be at attractive prices. No one can control what the market will do next. You can, however, take advantage of investment opportunities that exist today. At the same time, it is important to be well positioned for whatever the market does tomorrow. Please call me, Philip Biffle, or stop by my office today to develop your personalized recovery plan investment strategy. Please call me, Philip Biffle, at 229-0444, or stop by my office today to develop your personalized recovery plan investment strategy. Edward Jones, Making Sense of Investing, member SIPC.
Right, we're right back here on Meet Me at the Diner. We are having a fascinating conversation here this afternoon with Vernon Burton. He does live over there in 96. He came home. And Deb Marshall, she called in. She wants to get the email address to get some of your books. So let's go through that again.
Okay, it's V Burton, like Vernon Burton, V-B-U-R-T-O-N, at Clemson.edu. And if you lose it, there's a website I have called ageoflincoln.com. That's the name of my book, or theageoflincoln.com. And you can go there and email me. And again, you can call me. I'm in 96 and in the phone book. There's also on the Clemson website. There are ways to contact me there as well. Or Amazon has most of them, and the different publishers that publish them, like the University of South Carolina Press, University of North Carolina Press, University of Georgia. My agent, they will have them as well, but I'm happy to let people have them at certainly my discount.
Absolutely. So his home number, 543-2552, that's 543-2552. Now, you are getting ready to go out of town, I understand, on Wednesday. Is that correct? Where are you headed?
Headed to Illinois. What I discovered only after I got back home is, as Thomas Wolfe said, you can't go back home again. I feel like probably I didn't realize that Illinois had become home, but after 34 years, the chancellor at the University of Illinois has asked me to come back to talk with her about some things. So I'm going back and giving a teacher workshop while I'm there for high school teachers.
Now, it's very interesting, Vernon, because you were telling me while you were at the University of Illinois, you never drove. You rode a bike, and it was kind of like, I guess, culture shock when you came home. You didn't realize what you had gotten accustomed to.
Well, you know, I came to see my mother every month while she was alive, and I usually drove, you know, those 12 hours all night long listening to books on tape with five little girls lined up in sleeping bags in the pack asleep to get here. But it is different when you come and visit with your mother than when you live here, I think. And you know, I think what I had to understand was I knew she was, you know, not here in my head, but I'm not sure I knew it in my heart. And 96, I particularly associated with my mom. And there's not a worse mother's boy than I've ever been, no matter what Freud says. You know, I love my mom, still do, and I associate all the good things. But without her here, I think that was what really made it home for me.
Absolutely.
Plus, I studied the South.
Absolutely. You know, it is interesting that you said you had to go north to find out you were a Southerner, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I had to come back south to sort of, maybe like Lincoln, I'd become a Midwesterner without realizing it. But it is a different, you know, it is a different, and the South has changed. It's exciting ways it's changing. But, you know, I used to get upset at Illinois, and I said, I'm going to quit and come home, Mama. And she said, well, what will you do? I said, well, I'd worked in the cotton mill when I was 16 to 18, went off to college to Furman. And she said, well, there's no more cotton mills, you know. So, well, I'll farm. She said, well, you'll be the only one can make a living out of it down here then and stuff.
Yeah.
So it's really changed when you think about when I grew up here and what 96 is now. You hear Fuji Japanese company is the largest employer in the county. We talked earlier about the emergence of sort of a pluralistic society and a diverse society. It was basically black and white, and now you have a significant Hispanic, let alone the Japanese, and many Indian, and some wonderful restaurants. I have been very impressed with the restaurants in Greenwood, I must say, and 96.
Sure. But, you know, one of the things we were talking about, and you are writing another book, and you're writing your presidential address, but is how the South is being perceived on TV.
Yeah.
I mean, have you ever heard of so many redneck shows? And what do you think, as a historian, what do you think, why is it so popular?
Well, there's always been the fascination with the South. There are two things, and I don't want to say the other word, but we have at Clemson, as part of the Cyber Institute, the only university now, others will get them, social media listening center, where you can actually study. So those of you who tweet, you need to be careful. All the tweets done, Facebook's where they're opening things, and see what people are saying. And one of the things I want to do is see about the South. And, of course, whether it's true or not, and I don't think it is, as people have taught, it's different now, is whether the South was racist or not. So we want to see how words were used. So we looked at the N-word, and ironically, it's not used in the South as much. But what has happened, the N-word has been adopted by African-Americans, particularly about rap and things, and they've got their little handles. They've named themselves that, and so they show up. I mean, it's an irony, and I think a similar thing. And so African-Americans can speak to each other using that term that I think no white should ever use, and it can be seen as
well,
okay.
Well, white would get in a big trouble if
they
said this.
And they
this
should
word.
Be, and they should be.
But
African Americans can do it, and do it, and it's fine. But that's among them. But redneck has gone from a derogatory term now that it's being embraced by
that's
people,
right.
And in a similar way of that. And I find it just fascinating that it's coming. Maybe it's Jeff Foxworthy who. I don't know how he could claim to be a redneck when he worked for IBM before he became a comedian. And then there's a Nebraska guy who's Larry the Cable Guy, I think, but he's from Nebraska, pretends to be, you know, a Southern redneck sort of making fun of it. But there's always been that element of the South. There's always been that element of the South is larger than life. And elements. And I've often told people it's like the three blind men trying to describe the elephant. It really matters if you grab the tail, the trunk, the side, or a leg, because it's a different South. The South is many things, made up of many different parts. And I think it's those contradictions that made us so fascinated by the South. You know, there's the renowned Southern hospitality, and contrast that with the renowned Southern violence. The fact, the saying I like is, you know, a Southerner is polite to you up until the moment they're mad enough to kill you, and then you're in trouble. So, you know,
or the Southerner says something nice to your face, and then
right.
The minute you turn your back, they're saying, can you believe she wore that? Yeah. Those are all things that are so
real. But
there's
contradictions, and
yeah.
I think you don't catch those contradictions in other parts. You don't. They're probably there, but I don't think people think of the Northeast as being contradictory. In fact, they don't think of the South that way, but they look at it and see these contradictions and get fat. You don't think of the Midwest as sort of being having, you know, all these different parts and things. And
you think of the Midwest actually of wholesomeness and farm girls, and you know, this is what you think about. Yeah,
yeah, it is. And the South, you get mixed. And the South on race fascinates me because when I was growing up, as part of the Civil Rights Movement, it was like the map of the United States was tilted, so all the evils rolled down in the South. It was very convenient for the rest of the United States. Oh, look, there's an evil play. But the image has shifted, and now you look at the movies, you read the books. The South is considered the place of good race relations. So you'll see people say, we need to be like the South, where they have good race relations, and black and whites get along. And it is true. You go into a barbecue place, you'll see a black and white worker sitting down eating together. You don't see that as often in the North. Now, part of it is there are not as many African Americans they've seen as outsiders and strangers themselves. But I find it very interesting. We've created another myth of the South, I think, in a way that, you know, you see all these movies and television shows, and African American child is growing up in Chicago and they're getting in trouble. So the parents send them down to live with the grandparents down in Mississippi, and they get all straightened out because of the wholesome life and great things.
Because they whoop their ass. Hey, we are right here on WCRS. We are here with Vernon Burton. So, Vernon, we've got to wrap this up.
Sure.
But how would you like to wrap this up? I mean, this has been a fascinating conversation. I'd love to have you come back again and talk to us again.
Sure, anytime. It's a great honor to be here, and, you know, I hope people do read. Of course, I want to sell my books, but whatever books. I'm a great advocate for books and reading because I think, as we were talking about democracy, the thing that we try to do at a place like Clemson, I think, is to teach critical thinking. No matter what your political views, you want to learn to be critical and think. And I think reading is critical to that element for all of us. So I would encourage people to read. And, you know, I argue that history is an interpretation. You don't have to accept my view. I actually, this website I did, The Age of Lincoln, I tried to show this by putting other people's points of view there as well and show how I differ and why. And what I tried to do was to marry the internet and the book. And so I tried to put all of the primary sources, that is the original sources that are in the public domain, there so that people can see where my interpretation comes from and why mine differs. Because I think history, like life, is an interpretation.
Absolutely.
So I encourage people, in fact, one of the things I make my students do, they know in all my classes, I have to write, one of their exam questions has to be, prove me wrong and show how what I say is wrong and somebody else is right. So I think that's important to learn to think critically if we're going to continue to have this greatest of all countries, this democracy.
Absolutely. And, of course, probably one of the biggest things is, as you look at the internet and all the things that are happening out there, you do have to question the sources.
Yeah.
It's not just because it's on the internet, it's right.
Exactly. We had this sort of discussion offline, so they didn't hear us. But
it
is something that disturbs me, that we need to learn. In education, this is 1862, so this will be 150 years now for the Abraham Lincoln signed the Morrill Act, which is land-grant colleges, which gave us a school like Clemson. The education is critical to democracy, and Lincoln understood this. I think so many other people understood it, and I think we've got to find ways to support education. So that's the other thing I would leave to people. I try to remind them that 1862 is the sort of foundation in some ways of this sort of public education and college, and trying to say people should go to college, even farmers like me, and industrial workers and others, to get all the opportunities. Education is critical to democracy and the survival of democracy.
Absolutely.
In its broadest sense.
Well, Vernon Burton, thank you so much for coming out here today.
Well, thank you. It's been so much fun. I really enjoyed talking with you, and I hope we get another chance.
Absolutely. Now, if you'd like to contact him, his home phone, 543-2552, and, of course, your website, ageoflincoln.com.
Right.
Is where you'd be able to find, to be able to communicate with him, see about his books. You did also say they are on Amazon.com.
Right. Most of them are Amazon, or with the publishers as well.
Absolutely. Thanks so much today.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun. It was a real honor meeting you and talking with you.
Thank you very much. This is WCRS right here in Greenwood. Andy, I think you can take it away. I got a lot to do. Woo! We've been busy here at the gallery this afternoon. I'm going to have to bypass happy hour, unfortunately. Oh, bye-bye, everybody.